Okay, we were talking about scurvy, I think, last. Not to be confused with scabies, that's a different disease. This top picture here is what granulation tissue looks like. I think you can see it's got a lot of blood vessels. Okay, that's because of a basic fibroblast growth factor. You see a lot of inflammatory cells in here, from platelets to, plasma cells and lymphocytes. Very, very rich vascular tissue, and it's absolutely essential for normal wound healing. You all know what this is? Keloid, you know. Don't make the big deal between a hypertrophic scar and a keloid. That's all baloney. Basically, a keloid is, or hypertrophic scar is a scar, is just an excess in type 3 collagen deposition. Okay? And it causes these tumor-looking types of lesions on the skin. In terms of keloids, there is a genetic predisposition. We see it very commonly in the black population, but I've got keloids pretty much too, so it can have some genetic increase. Now, this is a white little child here. What do you think was the underlying cause of this kid's keloids? Third-degree burn. Now, as they've been hitting a lot lately, the relationship of squamous cell carcinoma to scar tissue and third-degree burns. There was one that caused a lot of people, I'm sure, to get this one wrong. They said something about a chronically draining sinus tract in the skin, and they tried putting antibiotics on it and didn't work. This ulcered lesion on the orifice of this chronically draining sinus tract. They said antibiotics didn't work, nothing worked. What is it? The answer is squamous cell carcinoma. You see, there's a lot of turnover that goes on in this scar tissue. And that gave you the impression that, you know, type 3 collagen is converted over into type 1 collagen. Well, that means fibroblasts are involved. And there's cell divisions going on. And whenever you have cell divisions going on, there's always a chance for mutation and cancer. And it's usually squamous. So I want you to remember that squamous cancer is very, very common in the setting of scars related to third-degree burns. In fact, big time. Big time. And also from chronically draining sinus tracts, like you see in chronic osteomyelitis, right at that orifice of the draining sinus tract. There's a lot of hyperplasia, epithelium going on there, and it predisposes to squamous cell carcinoma. So they've been hitting that over the last year, year and a half on that particular concept. So I figured I would share that with you so you get another point on the test, if you happen to get that question. Okay, chronic inflammation. Let's compare acute with chronic. A lot of good immunology here. What's the main immunoglobulin of acute inflammation, please? IgM. Wonder why that is? At least I think the reason I think it why it is that, you know, you need a lot of complement components, don't you? Like C3A and C5A and C3B and all those different complement components involved in the healing process. And what's the most potent activator of the complement system? IgM, and why is that? It's got 10 antigen recognition sites. The pentamer. And so all you need is one IgM. Boom, you got that classical pathway. And it's going to go from 1 to 9 in terms of the complement cascade. IgG requires two of them to activate the classical system, and it doesn't go beyond C3. I bet you, I only found that out recently, actually. I thought that, you know, when you activated the complement system, went from 1 to 9, period. No. If it's activated by IgG, it only goes to C3 and stops. Okay, so it doesn't go down to 5 and 6, 7, 8, and 9. And so you're not going to get your C5A, which is part of the, you know, the anaphylotoxins. And C5A was important as a chemotactic agent with IgG. And so IgM is the primary one we see in acute inflammation initially, not IgG. But then, you know, after 10 days to 2 weeks, there's an isotype switching, where that same plasma cell that was making IgM, you splice out the Mu heavy chain. Remember, it's the heavy chain that defines the specificity of an immunoglobulin. And it splices in a gamma heavy chain, and all of a sudden the same plasma cell is making IgG. So it's not a question of different cells making it. It's the same one that was making M now makes G by isotype switching. And then IgG is the primary immunoglobulin. But IgM first, then IgG later. Chronic inflammation is a very, very brief, maybe a couple hour phase of IgM, stint, but then it goes right to IgG immediately. So the main immunoglobulin of chronic inflammation is IgG, not IgM. The cells are different. Acute inflammation, the key cells are neutrophil. Now, of course, we're talking about the standard types of acute inflammation. It's neutrophil. If you're talking about an acute allergic reaction, what's the one of the key cells you see? Eosinophils, very, very commonly. And, of course, mast cells are in tissue, so you're not going to be seeing those. If we're talking about viral infections, what's the main acute inflammatory cell? Lymphocytes. So, you know, the main actor can be a little bit different depending on the type of acute inflammation. But as a rule, it's neutrophils. Now, when we talk about chronic inflammation, then we're talking about the monocyte and macrophages being the key. We're going to see plasma cells, a lot more plasma cells, and a lot more lymphocytes in tissue. We're not going to see pus. Pus or exudate is not a characteristic of chronic inflammation. That's a characteristic of acute inflammation. Basically, when we have that increased vessel permeability and we have emigration of neutrophils into interstitial tissue, that protein-rich fluid, which is greater than 3 grams of protein per deciliter, and that cell-rich fluid is called an exudate, which basically is pus. That's what pus is. Okay, produces a tumor of acute inflammation. You're not going to see an exudate in chronic inflammation. Okay, so I think those would be the big difference. Difference in immunoglobulins, difference in cell type as well, and absence of exudate. I just put a picture of chronic cholecystitis as a good example of chronic inflammation. But here's another good one, and that's the granuloma. When you talk about granuloma, there is no such thing as an acute granuloma. It's going to be, maybe that needs a little, I can't focus from up here. Can you see if you can get that bottom one a little bit better than that? Or maybe it's just not good. That's good. Thanks. This is a granuloma. This is a portion of lung that was split in half like that. So that's one half of it. That's the other. And so this is caseous necrosis of someone with TB. I want to take you through the formation of a granuloma. They're easy to identify, guys. You don't have to be a pathologist to identify this. If it's roundish and pink, and the key thing, you see multinucleated giant cells, guys, it's a granuloma. Period. Don't even think twice. They're not going to say, what is this? That's one-step reasoning. They're going to say, what's the pathogenesis of this? Answer is type 4 hypersensitivity. Okay, delayed reaction hypersensitivity. So we need to know who the main actors are in that. But some of you may not realize that cytotoxic T cells, when they kill, let's say, neoplastic cells, or they kill virally infected cells, that's also type 4 hypersensitivity. There's no antibody involved in that, is there? So that's another type of type 4 that you oftentimes forget. You always think granulomas, type 4. Well, yeah, well, how is that going to explain poison ivy? Okay, poison ivy actually is a type 4 hypersensitivity reaction, not type 1. Okay? So those are examples of delayed reaction hypersensitivity. So here's the way it works. We use TB as an example, droplet infection, you recall. The alveolar macrophage is phagocytosis it. Nothing happens. The alveolar macrophage takes it on a tour all around the body. It's called the lymphohematogenous spread. Still no problem. Kind of introducing the tuberculous organism to say, hey, there's an epididymis here. Would you like to come here? That looks pretty interesting, but no, I'll pass on that. Well, it kind of takes a little trip, but meanwhile, that little macrophage is doing what macrophages do best, processing antigen. It's been processing that TB organism, or whatever else it's been phagocytosis, processes antigen. Then after weeks or so, it presents it to who? A helper T cell. So the key actors in delayed reaction hypersensitivity are macrophages that process antigen, and then they're going to present that antigen via their class 2 antigen sites, and present it to helper T cells. Now, helper T cells are going to release all those cytokines. The ones that are involved in this granuloma are gamma interferon and the macrophage inhibitory factor. There are other cytokines like interleukin 2 and other kinds of things that have different functions. But the ones that really are involved in granulomas, gamma interferon and macrophage inhibitory factor. The gamma interferon is going to activate the macrophage to kill the TB, the cryptococcus, the histoplasmosis, or whatever other types of things that macrophages normally kill. Okay? So it's the gamma interferon that actually is the trigger for the macrophage to kill those organisms. The macrophage by itself cannot kill it. But when it gets activated by gamma interferon, it does kill it. Okay? And since systemic fungi and mycobacterium have a lot of lipid in the cell wall, we get a caseous necrosis. Now, all these pink staining cells that you see here are epithelioid. Remember that term, oid means looks like but isn't. They're not epithelial cells, they're activated macrophages. So an epithelioid cell is an activated macrophage. It's been activated by gamma interferon. When they die in style. They basically fuse together and they form multinucleated giant cells. It's kind of like their gravestone, in a sense. That's the way I look at it. Also helps us dumb pathologists to recognize it's a granuloma. We see them, you know. Oh, there's one, okay, but it's granuloma, okay, all right. And so those are also just fused epithelioid cells, macrophages. A lot of also the black dots that aren't pink would be the helper T cells in this. So the two main actors in a granuloma are helper T cells, CD4, and macrophages. Now, the first part of the story here in terms of there's two subsets of helper T cells. There's subset 1 and subset 2. Subset 1 is involved in type 4 in this type of hypersensitivity reaction. Macrophages have an interleukin called interleukin 12. And when a macrophage secretes interleukin 12, it causes the subset 1 helper T cells, it activates or it presents the antigen to them. Okay? And so what they turn out to be, the subset 1 CD4 helper T cells, they become the memory T cells of the event. They're the only ones that can retain memory of this thing. It's interleukin 12 that actually made that that connection with the memory of the antigen experience with that particular subset. Okay, and that's how there's memory of the fact that you have been presented with TB at some time in your life. The subset 1 helper T cells that are involved in that. Interleukin 12 was important in that reaction. Okay, so most people in their first primary disease usually recover with no problem. And they get these granulomas, oftentimes become calcified dystrophically, and you can see them on x-ray. But don't be fooled, like I was at one time, thinking that a calcified granuloma and someone with TB, everything has to be dead in it, and I even decalcified it for 3 months in this decalcifying solution, formalin, and I cut through it eventually. I said, there's no way I can. You look at all those caseous necrosis, they must be dead as a doornail, and I converted. I mean, that doesn't mean religiously. I mean, I had a TB conversion, okay? So they are incredibly, incredibly resistant to dying. And that's why most cases of most cases of the secondary TB are reactivation TB. They're reactivation of TB that was already there in some of those calcified granulomas you still have hanging around there. So most is reactivation. So let's explain a positive PPD then. Okay, how does that work? That's purified protein derivative. Okay? So you inject it into the skin. A little bit of this purified protein derivative. Now, who is the histiocyte or the macrophage of the skin? What's the name of that cell? Langerhans cell. Basically a histiocyte. So what's their marker? Cluster designation 1. All histiocytes, macrophages are cluster designation 1. So some Langerhans cells, those dudes that have Burbic granules that look like tennis rackets on electron microscopy. They are the macrophage histiocyte of the skin. So they phagocytose that purified protein derivative, okay? And they process it very quickly, actually. And who do you think they're going to present it to? They're going to present it to that helper subset 1 that has memory of previous exposure to that protein in the wall of the mycobacterium. And so it hooks in by class 2 antigen sites, as all immune cells do. And once it gets presented with this purified protein derivative that's been processed now by the Langerhans cell, the helper T cell releases cytokines, producing the inflammatory reaction with the induration, which we call a positive PPD. Okay, so that's how a positive PPD works. A good correlation with this thing would be, what about older people? Well, older people usually don't host a very good type 4 hypersensitivity. And so oftentimes they have less of a brisk response to a PPD. Sometimes you have to actually do a double type of PPD testing on them. So they have a less of an immune response. What about a patient with AIDS? Well, isn't it the helper T cell that's the main thing that's decreasing, huh? So they may not get any reaction, and yet be basically a culture medium for the organism. Would a person with AIDS have a granuloma in tissue? Not possible. It's impossible. There's no helper T cells. There's not enough of them to be able to form this granuloma. That macrophage inhibitory factor, which I didn't mention, actually keeps the macrophages in that area, and that's why you get a very localized granuloma. And so when you've got HIV and your helper T cell count's decreased, you don't form granulomas at all. And that's why you have basically TB organisms, Mycobacteria, Mavium intracellulare, even more common than MTB, all over the body. No granulomas. No granulomas. That's because the helper T cells are decreased. When you do PPDs on them, you accept 5 millimeters. It's enough to cause, if you've got a 5 millimeters in duration, that's enough to say it's positive, because that would be a pretty good immune response for a patient that's HIV positive to PPD. Okay, so I just wanted to mention those little corollaries with this. So you must know how a granuloma forms, and what I told you is the way it works. And a positive PPD. You need to know how that one works, too. Okay, reactions to injury. Heart, unfortunately, its reaction to injury, since it's permanent tissue, is scar tissue. Does scar tissue contract? No. So the more damage you have to your free wall of your left ventricle, what do you think is going to happen to the ejection fraction? That's your stroke volume divided by end-diastolic volume. Goes down because fibrous tissue doesn't contract. There's some stuff happening now where they can get cardiac muscle to go into the cell cycle and divide, and that's pretty cool stuff. They found something that's beginning to work on that, so we may have something that will prevent that from happening in the reasonably near future. Kidney, how does that react to injury? Same thing. It's going to form scar tissue. If I had to ask you which part of the kidney is most susceptible to, let's say, ischemia, what would you say? Medulla. And if I ask you what specific parts of the nephron, you had renal physiology, what's the most susceptible part of the nephron to tissue hypoxia? What do you think? Well, actually two places. Probably numero uno is the straight portion of the proximal tubule. Why? Because most of the oxidative metabolism is located in that. That's the part that has the little brush borders and all that stuff. That's where most of the reabsorption of sodium and, you know, the reclaiming of bicarbonate, all those different things, you know, the proximal tubule does, just about everything, is in that straight portion of the proximal tubule. That's considered the most susceptible. A close second, however, is the medullary segment of the thick ascending limb. I'll show you a picture of a nephron somewhere down the pike this afternoon. That's where the sodium-potassium 2-chloride co-transport pump is, where Lasix, loop diuretics block. Okay, that area, that thick ascending limb in the medullary segment, is supposed to be a very close second for getting destroyed in tissue hypoxia. So the straight portion of the proximal tubule is number one, and the thick ascending limb medullary segment with that very, very important pump, the sodium-potassium 2-chloride co-transport pump, is located. Just for fun, you had renal fizz, yes? What's the pump do? Generates free water, guys. Free water. Remember, in your urine you have two kinds of water, obligated and free. Obligated means it's obligated to go out with every sodium, every chloride, every potassium. That's basically 20 mLs of water has to go out with every sodium. We're not birds. That just has, you know, concentrated urea. That's it. Okay, can you imagine a bird that had actual urine? Okay, would have a tough time flying up there with a full bladder. Okay? Okay, so it just kind of concentrates it down. It don't need any free water. But we do. Because that's the only thing that antidiuretic hormone can reabsorb or get rid of, is free water, not obligated water. And that pump generates free water. So if I just for fun, just to make sure that you understand this concept, this is all I'm going to even talk about this, because I get the feeling that you didn't know that, some of you. Free water is a very important concept, guys. And I don't have time to go over that aspect and path, because I got other things even more important than that. I already told you need 20 mLs to get of obligated water for every sodium, every chloride, and every potassium. It's obligated. So how do you think you're going to generate water that isn't obligated? where you're going to take the sodium and the potassium and the chloride away from its obligated water. And that pump does it. That sodium, potassium, 2-chloride co-transport pump. Okay, I just reabsorbed one sodium. How much free water did I leave behind in the urine now? 20. I just reabsorbed one potassium. How much more do I have now? Another 20. I'm up to 40. I just reabsorbed 2 chlorides. How much do I have there? 40. So how much, by reabsorbing a sodium, potassium, and 2 chlorides, remember they balance each other in charge, you got 2 positives and 2 negatives with the chloride, how much free water did I generate? 80. That's how it does it. And that's the pump. That's the pump that Lasix blocks. And that's in the thick ascending limb medullary segment. I'll show you a picture. You have one in your notes, not in the path notes, but in the physiology notes. I go through renal fizz, because that's the part that students have trouble with. All right. Lung. Who's the repair cell of the lung? The type 2 pneumocyte. It can even repair type 1s and replace them. What is its other function, please? It synthesizes surfactant. Very good. That's the type 2 pneumocyte. So that's the repair cell of the lung. Central nervous system. The astrocyte. The astrocyte proliferates because it is a stable cell. It's not a neuron. It can proliferate and it produces the increase in their protoplasmic processes. That's called gliosis. And that's the reaction to injury in the brain is an astrocyte proliferation. Kind of analogous to the fibroblast laying down type 3 collagen in a wound. Okay? The astrocyte just proliferates, and so it has more of these little processes that stick out. And that's its reaction to injury, is that one. And then the peripheral nervous system, and this you'll have to do on your own, Wallerian degeneration. Big time board question, guys. You cut a nerve in half, what happens? You know, what's the role of the Schwann cell? And all that kind of stuff. That's stuff you should have had with some other lecturer during your board review. But if you didn't get it, it's right there at the end of that chapter, the mechanism of how an axon regenerates itself, that's called Wallerian degeneration, when you cut a big nerve in half. So that's the reaction of the peripheral nervous system. Just for fun, common board question. What is the analogous cell in the central nervous system to the Schwann cell? The oligodendrocyte. What do they both have in common? They both make myelin. Schwann cell in the peripheral nervous system, oligodendrocyte, central nervous system. Very good. Anybody know a tumor of the Schwann cell? Schwannoma. Okay. What's another name for that if it involves the 8th nerve? Acoustic neuroma. Very good. And what genetic disease, which is autosomal dominant, has an association with them? Neurofibromatosis. Very good. Are we sharp in this room? Say yes. All right. Okay? Don't say, no, I don't know the answers to these things. Well, now you do. Okay? Look at it in a positive thing, not a negative way. There's a lot of things you don't know. There's a lot of things I don't know. I learn something new every day. And things I should know, I forget. Not good. But, so, you know, just don't get down on yourself. Just say, hey, didn't know it, now I do. And the more you can, reinforce it by going over stuff, the more it's in your head. The less you reinforce it, it's gone. It is off in space. Okay? That's how some of you are getting to look towards the end of this morning's session. This afternoon will be even worse. That's why I've had Tensilon injections put into each seat. When both eyelids droop, you're going to feel a little sharp prick in your little buttocks, okay? And your myasthenic crisis will have ended as we increase acetylcholine in your synapses of your eyelids. I just gave you the whole concept of myosine. Isn't that cool? All right. Even my jokes have something to learn from. Okay, sed rate, erythrocyte sedimentation rate, the most worthless test there is, and yet one of the most common ones ordered, and it means absolutely nothing. What it is putting blood, whole blood, into a little cylinder that's kind of perpendicular to a flat surface there, and you see how many millimeters in an hour it settles, the red blood cells settle. I think it's pretty clear that if they're stuck together like this, anybody know what that's called when it looks like coins? Rouleau. or if they're aggregated together like this, I think maybe the weight or the density is greater, and therefore I would expect those to settle pretty quick, and we'd have an increased head rate. Okay, so what's the cause of this? Well, an increase in IgG and or fibrinogen. Well, that includes every acute and chronic inflammation that exists. Okay? Now, what causes RBCs not to rule low, but kind of stick together in clumps? Well, IgM. Because there's a negative charge that normally keeps RBCs from sticking to each other. And so there has to be some kind of thing that has a so big that it can offset that negative charge that repels RBCs from normally sticking to each other. That would be IgM. And you learned in immunology that was a cold or warm reacting antibody, please? Cold. So when we talk about cold agglutinins, what are we talking about? IgM antibodies. Okay? And they commonly produce that, agglutination. That's why in cold weather, you can get Raynaud's phenomenon. You go outside and your nose turns blue, your ears turn blue, the tips of your fingers turn blue, and you come inside and it goes away. If that doesn't mean cold something, then there's something wrong with the synapses going on in one's brain. You know, go out in the cold, you turn blue. You come in and you're warm, you turn pink. Obviously, there's some kind of cold reacting something doing that. Well, one of them could be an IgM antibody producing cold agglutinins, like this, causing these RBCs to agglutinate in your digital vessels, in your little nose and your ears, and so you're getting ischemia to those areas. And then you go inside, and it warms up, and it falls apart because once you get your blood warmed up a little bit, IgM can't work. It falls off. Okay? And this goes away. It could also be cryoglobulins. These are weird types of globulins. It has nothing to do with IgM that congeal. They're in the plasma that congeal in cold weather. So cryoglobulins can also produce that kind of symptomatology. And, of course, both of these have been on boards with that scenario. IgM antibodies can do the scenario I just gave you, so can cryoglobulins. What letters does that begin with? C. What hepatitis begins with C? C. So, okay, there's a high association with hepatitis C with cryoglobulins, very good. Okay. Sometimes I have to really coax you into getting the answer to this. So both of these things increase the sedimentation rate. Which one do you think it would be? This one on your right or this one on the left with multiple myeloma? Left, because that's IgG most of the time. Which about Waldenstrom's macroglobulinemia? What's a macroglobulin? IgM. So is that going to be the one on the left or the one on the right? Right. Okay. Because it's IgM. That's increase in Waldenstrom's macro. Macro begins with M. That's the main immunoglobulin. IgM. So you get more of this. Whereas in multiple myeloma, which is most commonly IgG, you get that. Okay. All of these increase the set rate. Totally worthless test, though. Oh, we didn't do the rest of this stuff. If I had acute appendicitis, which you don't, thank God, you get a CBC, complete blood cell count. What do you expect? You want to see what? Give me words. I want to see an absolute neutrophilic leukocytosis. Good. What does that mean? Oh, no. There's something absolute. Very good. Okay. What it means is that you truly have an increase in the number of neutrophils in your peripheral blood. Okay? You have more in there out there than normal. Okay? What else are you looking for? Toxic granulation. Okay? Well, that's a subjective thing. I can tell you the granules and these neutrophils is way more granules than it should be. More azurophilic granules than it should be. Okay? We'll tell you why in a second. What else you want to see? Left shift. What does left shift mean? Okay? Well, assuming that you start from a myeloblast on the left, and that eventually, through a series of divisions, forms a segmented neutrophil on your right. We normally go from left to right in maturation. So when we do left shift, it means that we go back to immature neutrophils. And the definition is greater than 10% band neutrophils, otherwise known as stabs, is considered left shift. Every one of these neutrophils is a band. That one is, and that one is. If you had greater than 10% of 100 cells by definition, that would be left shifted. If you even had one metamyelocyte or one myelocyte, boom, that's automatically left shifted. Forget the bands. Okay, so what we in review see in acute inflammation, let's say acute appendicitis, is an absolute increase in neutrophils with toxic granulation and left shift. Left shift. Those are the key things that we see. Now, guys, what did we say was the most potent system for killing bugs? Say it. Oxygen-dependent myeloperoxidase system. Where did I tell you myeloperoxidase was located, please? In the azurophilic granules, those little red granules, which are what, please? The lysosomes. Wouldn't you like to have a lot of those around if you had an acute inflammatory reaction? Because that means we'd have more myeloperoxidase around to kill the bugs. Is that correct? That's what toxic granulation is. It's ensuring that we have enough myeloperoxidase around to work that most potent system we have to kill bugs, the oxygen-dependent myeloperoxidase system. So it makes more of them, and that's what we call toxic granulation. Dolly bodies, forget. They're totally worthless. These are Dolly bodies if you're interested. Done with inflammation, guys. We're on fluid and hemodynamics. Hope you had good renal fizz. Very important. I put a lot of my renal fizz notes in the physiology high yield. So if you're weak on it, that'll make you strong. You're weak on immunology, just taking a look in the high yield's microbiology. I took the best of my immunology kind of notes that I'd make for myself, and I stuck them in there. Everything about HIV you need to know is there. Okay, everything that's on boards, it's all still there. So high yield, very important for you. To kind of like the clinical aspects of some of the things that you learned that we don't have enough time in pathology to cover all of those as well. First thing I'm going to do is going to play a little game here between transudate, exudate, increased vessel permeability, and lymphedema. So the term that we're going to be using here and defining is edema. What is it? It's excess fluid in the interstitial space. So what compartment is that? Extracellular, intracellular. Extracellular. Is within a vessel or outside a vessel? Outside the vessel. That's the interstitial space, and there's excess fluid in there. That's called edema. Now, some edema is pitting. Some edema is non-pitting. Okay. Which one pits? Does increased vessel permeability with pus in the interstitial space, which is edema, does that pit? No. Okay. Would fluid, a transudate, someone with right heart failure, you see swelling of the lower extremities, is fluid in the interstitial space there? Would that pit? Yes. So exudates don't pit, transudates do pit. How about lymphatic fluid? You block the lymphatics and there's lymphatic fluid in your interstitial space. Does that pit? Early on it does, but after a while, no. So basically it's non-pitting. So the three things that produce edema are transudates, exudates, and lymphedema. Those are fluids in the interstitial space. And it's only the transudates that can produce pitting edema. The other ones are non-pitting. Now let's talk about transudates because they deal with Starling's forces. This guy Starling must have been important because it's the same dude that did Frank Starling, that Passo will teach you when he comes back to teach his cardiovascular next Monday. A week from today, because of that feigned sickness he had. Okay? And he will teach you about Frank Starling. That Starling is the same one that produces Starling's forces, which talks about those forces that keep fluids in our blood vessels and those things that try to push it out. What keeps fluids in our blood vessels? Albumin. We call that oncotic pressure. So 80% of the oncotic pressure is related to our serum albumin concentration. So anytime we have hypoalbuminemia, then we would have leaking of a transudate, a protein poor, less than 3 gram per deciliter, cell poor fluid, probably through capillaries and venules that just leak out into the interstitial space, and that would be pitting edema. Now what's normally in our vessels trying to push fluid out? Hydrostatic pressure. Okay, so who's normally winning in a normal person in our blood vessels. Oncotic pressure is winning over hydrostatic pressure, or we would all be squishing our way down these stairs with dependent pitting edema, which mainly would be in your butts from sitting here all that time. Okay, of course, if you did yoga, it'd be in your head. Okay, whatever is parts dependent gets the fluid. Okay, that's all I can tell you. So what could produce transudate, protein-poor, cell-poor fluid on our interstitial space? A decrease in oncotic pressure and an increase in hydrostatic pressure. That's the concept. We're with each other. Yes or no? Okay, let's brainstorm albumin. Okay, where's it made? Liver. So you think if you had chronic liver disease, you'd have low albumin. Yes or no? So there's one cause. Okay, can we get rid of it in any part of our body? Just think of all your orifices. Can you vomit it out in significant amounts? Nah. Can you poo it out? Sure, it's called malabsorption. Can you pee it out? Sure, it's called nephrotic syndrome. Can it come off our skin? Sure, third-degree burn. Basically lose plasma. Okay, what's another possibility for a low protein count? We already saw one. Little kid with fatty liver. Kwashiorkor, we decrease our protein intake. Will that lower our albumin level? Yes or no? See, I did it in a logical fashion. I did it in a way where I was just asking myself questions about albumin. Where is it made? Liver. Okay, cirrhosis. Low. Can I excrete it anywhere? Okay, I can't sweat it out now, but I can have a third-degree burn. It can lose plasma. Yeah. Can I poo it out? Sure, it's malabsorption, lose protein. Okay, how about intake problems? Yeah, kwashiorkor. And how about can I pee it out? Sure, it's called nephrotic syndrome. I mean, there's no memorization involved at all. All it is thinking. Okay? Having it down, you've got to know the normal first before you can know the abnormal. You don't know the normal, how can you know the abnormal? You can't. All you can do is memorize it. That doesn't mean a hill of beans when a patient comes in because they don't have a question stamped on their forehead. I have A, B, C, D, E. Okay? The stem of the question, of course, is the chief complaint. The A, B, C, D, E is your history, physical, and laboratory tests. It makes it a lot tougher than a USMLE Step 1 exam. And memorization will not help you one iota. You have to be thinking doctors. Okay, so here we go. Are we ready to think? Say yes.
But I'm so tired from eating.
Well, that's your problem. You do know why you're tired? Because you're an alkaline tide. Because for every hydrogen that went into your stomach to make hydrochloric acid while you were thinking about food at around 11 o'clock, that was the cephalic phase of digestion at vagus nerve, as you know, which stimulates directly parietal cells and gastrin-secreting cells, G-cells. Every hydrogen that went into your stomach combined with chloride was a bicarb in your blood. And so you had developed a little bit of metabolic alkalosis. Okay. Just from thinking about food. And then you had your gastric phase of digestion. Okay? And now you're in your process of reabsorbing the food that you ate. And those hydrogen ions in the food will be reabsorbed and reunite with their bicarb, and you'll no longer be in metabolic alkalosis. But right now, a good many of you are still in it. I can just see you yawning and this and that. Because what's the compensation for metabolic alkalosis, please? Respiratory acidosis. What happens in respiratory acidosis to your PO2? Goes down. And so you have two reasons for tissue hypoxia right now, and it's all physiologic. Uno, where's your curve, your oxygen dissociation curve? It's left shifted. Okay? And what's your compensation for your metabolic alkalosis, respiratory acidosis, or what's your PO2? Decreased. So when you have tissue hypoxia, do you get tired? Of course.
So why did God do that to me?
So that you would sit still, so that the nutrients that you just ate can be used to store in different tissues of your body for a rainy day to help insulin do its job. That's why. If you up there after you ate, with all that ATP and all that stuff, you'd be using up the fuels that you should be storing. That's why God did that, not straight from Him. All right. So here we go. Got your hats on. You're already set. Big P right over there. You're all set. Okay, so you get the first one. No, I'm only kidding. Don't worry. A little click like this. You know what that was? Sphincter. All right. It's audible. It's always audible. When it's quick, fast, you can hear it. Well-trained ear can hear it. Okay, so here's a person that had a myocardial infarction 24 hours ago. He died, and this is his lung, and we have this fluid coming out. Okay? Transudate or exudate? Transudate. Okay? Mechanism. Decrease oncotic pressure, increase hydrostatic pressure. Which one? Increase hydrostatic pressure. Left heart failure or right heart failure? Left heart failure due to a myocardial infarction. So things backed up into the what's behind the left heart? Lungs. So because the cardiac output decreased, the end diastolic volume and pressure in the left ventricle increases. And that pressure is transmitted back into the left atrium. What empties into the left atrium is the pulmonary vein. Normally it has an 8 millimeter hydrostatic pressure, and the oncotic pressure is 25. So the oncotic pressure is winning by 25 minus 8, 17. And as the hydrostatic pressure keeps on going up, as it backs up into the lung, all that blood, okay, then it eventually approaches the oncotic pressure, then you start leaking the transudate into the interstitial space, which activates your J receptors, and you're starting to get dyspnea, Corley's lines on an x-ray, from that fluid in the interstitium. Then eventually goes full-blown into your alveoli, pulmonary edema, which is what this is. Wow. Okay. This patient was envenomated by a bee sting on the arm. And this happened to the face. Okay, exudate, transudate, lymphedema, what is it? It's an exudate, because this is what reaction? If the face swelled up with a bee sting over here, this is a anaphylactic reaction. So who's the main operator in this? Histamine. What type of hypersensitivity? One, increased vessel permeability. There's an exudate here. That's what's causing a tissue swelling. Very good. First step in management. Airway. Next step. Board question. Okay, 1 to 1,000 aqueous epinephrine subcutaneously. Okay, they expect any second-year medical student to know that. So that was a board question. Okay. Oh, this is going to be a fun one. This patient has cirrhosis of the liver. Okay, there's pitting edema in those legs. There's ascites there. Let's start here. Mechanism, transudate or exudate? Transudate, mechanisms. Two answers. Decrease oncotic pressure. Why? Can't synthesize albumin. What's the other one? Increase hydrostatic pressure. Why? Portal hypertension. Very good. Because you have cirrhosis of the liver and the portal vein empties into the liver, it can't. So the hydrostatic pressure increases in it, and it pushes the fluid out into the peritoneal cavity. So there's two mechanisms for the ascites. There's also one other one, that's an aldosterone, increase in aldosterone, reabsorbing salt and water. Okay, but here's pitting edema in the legs. I want the mechanism for that, please. Come on. Come on. Is it an increase in hydrostatic pressure? No. Is it a decrease in oncotic pressure? Yes. Okay, I'm changing the scenario. The patient that had left heart failure really didn't die. But then he started developing dependent pitting edema that looked like that. What would that mechanism be? An increase in hydrostatic pressure. When you're in right heart failure, then blood behind the failed right heart is your venous system. So isn't it interesting? These legs, depending on what the scenario was, has a different mechanism. If it's cirrhosis of the liver, then it's a decrease in oncotic pressure that did it. If it was a person with right heart failure, then it would be an increase in hydrostatic pressure that did it. Are you with me? This is boards. This is USMLE step one. That's the way they ask these things. You guys seem to be handling it okay. You should start feeling good. I want to feel bad. Well, that's nice. You want to do that? That's just fine. You just feel bad. All right. This patient had a modified radical mastectomy on that breast. Then developed this non-pitting type of edema diagnosis, lymphedema. This is the most common cause of lymphedema in this country. A lot of times in third world countries, it's Wuchereria bancrofti and different parasitic worms that screw up your lymphatics. Don't forget lymphogranuloma venereum, guys and gals. That also produces lymphedema. Remember, that's a subtype of Chlamydia trachomatis, and has this tendency of scarring tissue and lymphatics. And you can get lymphedema of the scrotum, you can get lymphedema of the vulva, associated with that. You're aware of inflammatory carcinoma of the breast, the peau d'orange appearance of the breast. That's also an example of lymphedema too, because if you do a section to the breast in this terrible form of breast cancer, you'll see the dermal lymphatics plugged with tumor. And so what happens is the lymphatic fluid leaks out into the interstitium, and then the ligaments that hold the skin down, tether the skin down, and get this excess fluid in there, you get this dimpling effect that looks like the surface of an orange. That's lymphedema too. But the number one cause of lymphedema in this country is post-radical mastectomy, and believe it or not, you can run the risk of lymphangiosarcoma when you have chronic lymphedema of any extremity. So you can end up with a sarcoma from this too. This is a horrible thing. She has to hold her hand, her arm up on that hand, because that probably weighs about 50 pounds, all that excess fluid in there. Not good. Not a good situation. Very hard to treat. Good. You did good. Now we'll see if you, what you learned about renal fizz. Okay. All right. Well, ECF, ICF. Kind of a great name for a kid, you know. Sure. We can call him nephritic, nephrotic. You know, that's not hey, nephritic, get over here. Nephrotic, you go. Okay? ECF, over here. ICF, go. All right. ECF is extracellular fluid, two compartments, vascular, interstitial. Interstitial is two-thirds larger than the vascular. ICF stands for intracellular fluid compartment. It's two-thirds larger than the ECF. Okay, so want an integration on that? I'll give you one. You give okay. How many liters of isotonic saline would you have to infuse in a patient to get 1 liter into the plasma? The answer is 3, because it's a two-third, one-third relationship. You have to get 3 liters of isotonic saline, because 2 of those liters would end up in your interstitial space, and only 1 of them would end up in your vascular compartment. See, that's why, in order to keep a patient's blood pressure up when you're hypovolemic or for whatever reason, you need to really infuse the isotonic saline, because it's not just staying in your vascular compartment. It's equilibrating with the interstitial fluid compartment. They actually asked that question on boards. Good question. Quite a lot of you. So that's an important concept that I want you to remember. Now, these diagrams over here are very commonly asked on boards, okay, in relationship to different fluid abnormalities, which we'll not go over, but I do have a question on it in my fluid and hemodynamics questions that you can fiddle with. Hopefully, it was discussed with you, but the height of the squares is the osmolality of the plasma. Okay, so this is so the height of this is a normal osmolality of plasma. And the width of these things is the volume in each of these chambers. So in other words, if I had a low plasma osmolality, then the height of this thing would be lower than this over here, be over here. If I had an increase in the ECF compartment volume, then it would be expanded out that way. If I had an increase in ICF volume, it would be expanded out that way. So the x-axis is basically volume. The y-axis is plasma osmolality for these things. We'll see what that means in a second. Osmolality. Okay, what is it? It's a measure of solutes in a fluid. That's what the osmolality is, and they measure it by different kinds of ways that you don't need to know. We talk about serum or plasma. The osmolality is actually mainly due to these three things that you see up here. Sodium, glucose, and blood urea nitrogen, otherwise known as BUN. All right? Now, they usually multiply sodium times 2. Why would they do that since it's only got 1 plus there? The answer is that's right, because it has chloride with it, and so it's 1 for the sodium, 1 for the chloride, and that's why they put 2. And we'll take off from there when you come back. That's if you come back. Okay?